I could imagine when Moses was preparing the people to go into the promised land, that his concerns really weren't so much about the giants that were in the land. Remember when they were about to enter in and the 12 spies went in, and of course 10 came back saying, oh, we can't take it. And because of their unbelief, God done 40 years of preparing the people to go back into the land because they didn't trust him on the first time. But I really don't think that was Moses' concern. As the people were going into that land, when we read it the second time in the book of Deuteronomy, I suspect that his fears was that the pagan nations that surrounded, that were going to surround the people of God, and their particular worldview, that was going to be more of a worry for Moses. When we think of the ideas that surround us, that we have to interact with on a daily basis, we realize that there is different worldviews that go on in that. And of course, for God's people, they needed to know who created the world, who created mankind. What about marriage? Who created marriage? Why is the world in such a mess? These were the big, big questions, folks, that really form our worldview as believers. And if we're wrong about those origins, well, we are not really on the right foundation, are we? And no doubt God's people going in to the land needed to know those the answers to those crucial questions. Or there was going to be no doubt there would be trouble. So God in his grace led Moses in the power of his spirit to write an account for us that really wrestle with and answer those questions. And that's why we're starting a series here on origins, origins of creation. And we look at several of them here in the first four chapters of Genesis. But if we think about wrong ideas and a worldview, we've got to be right on these things, folks. If we're off here on the real foundations of those crucial questions, who are we, where do we come from, what is our purpose in life? If we're off on those, well, we're in trouble, aren't we? Now, when we come to looking at Genesis 1, and that's what we're going to be looking at today, the account of creation, I suppose there's a lot of things that come to our minds, and as Mark was talking about the students here today and going into the universities, you sort of realise that when you start getting into Genesis 1, the first thing we tend to think of, oh no, this is so complex, isn't it? We think about science and we think about creation and we try and start thinking, how does this all fit? And maybe if you're here today, maybe those things are not crossing your mind. But maybe for some of you, no doubt they are. And certainly I can understand that. But I think what we need to realize as we begin here to look at Genesis 1, and I suppose there's a few things we need to clear up before we start going into it, because in many ways it's the elephant in the room, isn't it? That we need to talk about the approaches that people look when they come into a text like Genesis 1 and 2. And my argument is, in starting this, is that in Genesis 1, God's agenda is not when and how, But God's agenda is who and why, okay? Now, let me explain that, because when we come to a text like Genesis 1, what do we want to ask? Well, when, you know, when was it created? How was it created? And we're sort of intrigued with all the details. But I want you to know that was not the agenda when Genesis 1 was written, okay? God's agenda was who and why. In other words, who created and why did he create? Okay, so I'm not going to go into not going to go down in a sense into that road, because I fear, and I think a lot of times, because we approach Genesis 1 with those issues, we really miss what God is saying to us through the text and what he is saying about himself. And I fear a lot of times because we want to ask the when, and the how, we missed what God is wanting to communicate to us, which is the who and the why. Now, Genesis 1 and 2 is very interesting accounts, because Genesis 1 is really the overview of creation, and Genesis 2 is a sort of a is more of a detail of the creation. I suppose it's a bit like the Google, isn't it? Google Earth, you know, you get that big look down from the satellite into planet Earth, and you have the bigger picture, and then I suppose you go out to the streets and you have the Google, you know, the Google Maps, where they're able to go down the streets to have the camera on the car, and you just see all the slow motion, as it were, and looking at the streets. And Genesis 1 and 2 is a bit like that. One is the bigger picture, and then 2 is more of the detail of the creation and God's creation. In a sense, it sort of slows down. Now, I want to put up their creation stories, because again, when we come to Genesis 1, we think today like of Richard Dawkins and folks that maybe just deny that there's a creator, and of course many others in there as well. But again, the culture and context of Genesis 1 is that everyone sort of believed in God back when Genesis 1 was written. When I say believe in God, I mean believe in gods. Okay, so there was no such thing as atheists, okay? Everyone believed in some kind of a God. And that was the issue. And of course, the issue with Genesis 1 was which God created it. And of course, there's many myths around of the creation story, but certainly one of the major ones is that the gods were sort of fighting together, and somewhat out of this conflict and chaos, the world formed. And that was a fairly common belief back then. And so in that sense, that background is there with all that stuff going on. Let me say a few things about science and faith here as well, because again, I think that has to be addressed and has to be looked at, because many times Christians are often saying, how can I be true to science and true to faith? And somehow they think there's a bit of a conflict between those two, that you can't believe in both together. Well, of course you can. There are many good scientists who are believers. But you see, again, when people who struggle with the account of Genesis 1 and think about science, is they're trying to reconcile science and how it fits in with Genesis 1. And what we need to say about that is that Genesis 1 wasn't written in a scientific background. It wasn't written with scientific language. It was written in the language of popular an ancient culture. And of course, it wasn't written as a science account. And if we try to read in and think, you know, it's going to comment on science and all these, we're wrong. Now, the Bible does, when it does speak about science, it is right, and it makes comments on science. Of course, it's accurate. But that wasn't the way Genesis 1 and 2 was written. Again, it was written in the language of popular culture and ancient culture. So in many ways, it has the language of appearance. And let me give you an example of this. We do that in the secular world as well. Let's say Met Aaron now, who give us a weather forecast down there. There are head bases out there in Glasnevin beside the Botanic Gardens. When they are given the weather forecast and they turn around and say, well, there'll be sunrise and sunset, okay? Well, of course, there's no such thing as sunrise. In scientific language, there's no such thing as sunrise and sunset, is there? Yeah, the sun doesn't rise or it doesn't set. It's going around. But you see, we don't write in letters to Met Aaron giving out and complaining, that's scientifically wrong. We don't say that because we know they're using the language of appearance. You see what I'm saying? They're using the language of appearance. And in a sense, Genesis 1 is doing that as well. It's not written as a scientific account. So, in a sense, when we think about science, we have to be honest as well. Science is evolving as well in that sense, and science has theories that change. So just when you think you've aligned it up with Genesis 1, well, then another scientific theory changes once again. And, of course, scientific theories do change. And that's why, in many ways, they can't be the final word on anything. So I think that's the issue of science and faith. And you'll be disappointed this morning because I'm not going to be going through the account of Genesis 1 if you are wanting me to go into that whole area. Number one, I'm not really qualified to do it, but I want the text to speak for itself. And again, I want to go back to the fact that if we're coming with our agenda and what we want answered, and we're really going to miss what God is saying to us and what is the purpose of Genesis 1 and 2. How does it answer those big questions on origins? And what's the worldview of Genesis 1? Because God's people back when Moses wrote that account needed to know that and needed to be clear, because their faith in God was going to be attacked at every level. And if they weren't sure of what their foundations were in, there was a danger they were going to be led astray, wouldn't they? And I think that's the exact same for us. It hasn't changed. When we get into Genesis 1, it's just as relevant. That we adopt our worldview as Christians from what God says here in his word in regards to his creation. So let's look at the first two verses, because I believe this is background, by the way, for the rest of Genesis chapter 1, when it gives the first two accounts here of creation. Let's just read it. It says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And I believe verses 1 and 2 is background. It's background, and then really the story then of creation starts to come in the rest of Genesis chapter 1, beginning at verse 3. But do you notice here what it says first? It says, in the beginning, God. Isn't that just lovely? In other words, it's not in the beginning, us, or it's not in the beginning, creation. In the beginning, God. And folks, the fact here is that God is the ultimate reality, okay? When it comes to the universe that we live in, it doesn't start with us. It doesn't start with creation. It starts with God. God is ultimate reality. It begins with him. He's the creator. And such an important, for the very, for some important word in the very first part of the Bible, isn't it? And of course, the other thing it teaches us here as well is that God is also distinct from creation, isn't it? In other words, you know, when you think of views today, and boy, we haven't really advanced that much when you think of back when this was written, because obviously you have pantheism in that talks about God being in creation, and you know, he's in everything and everything is in God, and all these Eastern philosophies that we come up against a lot. And but when you think of this verse, clearly tells us, doesn't it, that God is distinct from his creation. And of course, back then they worshipped the creation, didn't they? They worshipped the creation as God. And of course, that's unbiblical. That's clearly wrong. And of course, today it's the same thing. If you go up to the Mind, Body and Spirit that's going to be on here in the RDS now at the end of October, at Halloween, you'll see a lot of those philosophies and ideas. And a major part of them is the worship of creation. It's worshiping creation instead of the God of creation. So we haven't really advanced too far at all. So with that background, we're given the account of the days of creation. The days of creation. And the layout of Genesis 1 is very interesting, because clearly we have 6 days of creation. We know on the seventh day God rested. But think of it this way. Days 1 and 3 of God's creation, God answers the idea of the previous verse we looked at. Remember in verse 2 when it says the earth was formless and empty, okay? Well, days 1 and 3 deal with the formless aspect of creation. In other words, God brings form out of that which is formless, okay? That's in days 1 and 3. And in days 4 and 6, God fills the form that he has made, okay? He fills that, so he answers the dilemma of the emptiness. The formlessness and emptiness that is in verse 2 is dealt with in these divisions of creation, is in 1 and 3 and 4 and 5. Now, some people have a hang-up with verses 1 and 2 when they think about, you know, why would God forced have something that's formless and empty? Does that mean like he made a mess of it or things? And people read a lot into those first two verses that we read in Genesis 1, 1 and 2. But really, that's not the case at all. That's really, God is just giving us the process of creation here. Then, in other words, it's the way he has filled things in. And I suppose a good example of that would be, if you ever see a house being built and it's sort of uninhabitable, you just see that maybe the structure of it up, but that's about all there's there. There's no wiring, there's maybe no windows in it, and you know, it's uninhabitable, you would say, okay? Now, you wouldn't turn around and say, oh no, that's a very bad house, you know, that's someone didn't really do a good job on that one. Well, no, because it's not finished yet. You know, it isn't done yet. And I think in verses 1 and 2, that's exactly what's going on. That's the background, and then God is going to deal with both of those aspects of making form out of that which is formless and filling in that which is empty. And that's the lovely process of creation that we're bought into. Well, let's read the first day. We read it here, Genesis 1, 3 to 5, and it says, "And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day." So there's that, just that simple bringing form out of that which is formless. And do you notice on each of these accounts we're going to hear, you have it here in the beginning on the first day, and God said. God spoke and creation came into being. And of course, that's going to be the pattern, isn't it, over the 6 days. And also in there, we see that word, and he saw that it was good. And that's to remind us that God's creation was perfect. It wasn't something that was done and needed to be repaired or sort of repeated later on. It was perfect. It was absolutely perfect. And here we're given the light and night and day. And some people say this is where God created time as well. You know, well, I mean, that's a possibility. This is where time, in that sense, as we know it, came into being. But again, it's the first day. And let's look at the second day where we read, and God said, let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above. And it was so. God called the expanse sky, and there was evening and there was morning the second day. So here what we call space and time, here in the first 2 days. Again, and God said. And we go on to day three again. And I think these texts are speaking for themselves in that sense. In that sense, they just don't need to be explained. They're just so literal. And we can clearly grasp and understand them, can't we? And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear. And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the third day. So again, do you see the lovely pattern here? God is forming that which is formless. And the land and the seas. And of course, the vegetation, which we know. Someone said to me today, you know, Ireland, an amazing place with the lovely flowers and the fruit trees and all of that. Well, of course, you have that all over the world. You don't just have it in Ireland. We happen to have lovely, fertile soil, don't we? But regardless of that, the point is you plant an apple seed, you'll get apples, won't you? And so forth. And of course, God, in his wisdom and perfection, created this. And then when we go to days 4 and 6, again, God is answering the question here of filling. Here he's going to fill these forms that he created in the first 3 days. And let's just read it and see as God did it here. And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark the seasons and days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. It was so. God made two great lights, the greater light he governed to govern the day, and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. Wow. Isn't it amazing? You look at this universe and hear as God created it by just speaking the words. It's breathtaking, and we're still discovering, aren't we, what that vast universe is like. And it just takes our breath away, doesn't it? And here's God filling it all up, isn't it? He's in this process of creation. It's a real orderly account, isn't it, of how he's forming that and how he's filling that up and creating it by his words. Have you noticed there it says greater light and lesser light? Now, that's kind of fascinating because we know what those two lights are, don't we? That's talking about the sun and it's talking about the moon. But you might say, why does he not mention them? Well, of course, the background of Genesis 1 is that people worshipped the sun. People worshipped the moon, you see. And in a sense, it's just like it's an after, you know, God is saying, oh, I created that. And in a sense, that the pagan... The pagans that worshipped these gods, and again, it was the sun god and the moon. And clearly in that background of Genesis 1, there's a sort of a put down in that sense of putting down those gods and in not even mentioning the sun or the moon, but the fact that God created them. By the way, have you noticed when it says, you know, 1, 2, 3, 5 words, and he made the stars? It's almost like an afterthought, isn't it? You know, you imagine you get a whole chapter on that and all of how it did and all the galaxies and the Milky Ways. And it just says, and he also made the stars. And of course, the background clearly to there as well is that stars were worshipped, by the way, just as they are today. And so here, I've no doubt that there is a bit of spiritual warfare going on in Genesis 1. Even though it's not mentioning it, there's a sense that the false gods are being put down, or being seen that they're not gods at all. There really is only one true God, and he's behind all of this. He is the one that spoke it into existence. And I've no doubt that there's some of that going on there as well. So then we go on to the fifth day, and we read, and God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living and moving thing with which the water teems, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was morning and there was evening, the fifth day. And of course, here again, God brings all the creatures into being, and birds and creatures of the sea. And again, when you see repetitiveness in Hebrew language, you just see that emphasis coming again. God said that it was good, and he saw that it was good. So we're seeing this just perfect creation that God is giving. And then we come to the final day, the sixth day. Now, the sixth day is very interesting because in many ways, the sixth day divides into two. There's two things going on here. And we think about God filling the earth. We think about the reproduction there. We've seen it in the fifth day, creatures and the birds. And we see this reproducing in that sense. And then we come to the sixth day, and there's two parts to that. And the first part here is what we read. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. So there's the first part of the sixth day here, the animals. And then we come into the next part, part two, which the uniqueness and the difference here, of course, is, well, we'll read it. It'll speak for itself, won't it? Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves. Wow, so we see the uniqueness here, don't we? Because here's mankind being created. And in a sense, it's very interesting that this is the apex, isn't it, of Genesis 1. And in a way, it's kind of been building up. And the way, of course, Genesis 1 is structured is here's the top of the mountain, as it were. Here's the apex of creation. And the apex of creation, of course, is man and woman being created here and uniquely set apart from the other creation. And that's clear to be seen because we see it there, don't we? The first line, let us make man in our image. And here's mankind again that's distinct from the rest of creation. In fact, is sovereign over creation, given the authority to rule over creation. That's clear. Now, I'm not going to go into that today. We're just looking at the overview. We're going to take another week looking specifically at the creation of mankind, a man and woman. I think it deserves that attention, not just a quick comment and the origins of where we come from. Let's face it, folks, we better understand that. If we're off on that, we're in big trouble. And so I'm going to give attention to that in a couple of weeks' time. But the fact here that God is made in the image of God, and here on the sixth day, God, in that sense, completes his perfect creation. He completes his perfect creation. Now, when we go on to the seventh day, we realize, and we know it's completed because the rest of Genesis, when we go on to the seventh day on the, because by the way, there was no chapter breaks in the original. Chapter breaks are not inspired, right? So there's a flow that goes on, and really it finishes in verse 4 of chapter 2. And of course, we know the creation was finished because we know it from these words here. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created, when the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. Wow, isn't that lovely? Do you see the way the writer is emphasizing there? This is the account. This is when it was finished. In other words, it wasn't a process, creation. Creation was done and it was absolutely perfect. Never needed to be repeated, never needed to be repaired. God's perfection. And the emphasis here is God created the heavens and earth. He did it. And you just see that just interwoven right through, don't you? From chapter 1, verse 1 to 2, verse 3. And by the way, when it says here God rested, we know this is not relaxation. The word here, rested, means he stopped. That's what the word means. I suppose when we think of rest, even though it comes from that word, the Sabbath, you know, we think of relaxing, you know, maybe what you're going to do on Sunday afternoon, go for a nap or put the feet up in the chair. Well, that's not what the word means here. It's not that God had to take a rest after his creation. It's that he stopped. That's basically the language that it's talking about here, that he stopped. And folks, There's something more significant to that, by the way, that we're going to take a look at here in our application. But really, when we stop here today, I think the issue that we need to be just reminding ourselves today, folks, is that God is the creator and sustainer of the world that we live in. And his glory and his majesty that we see in creation. And for us that look around at this marvel of what we see, we ought to be reminded of the God who created it and how amazing he is. And too often we just take that for granted. We're wrapped up in ourselves and we fail to just see the magnitude of God in his amazement and his perfection and his beauty and all that we learn about him as we look at the created world that we're in. It really ought to encourage us. So maybe that's something we need to remind ourselves today. But also we need to apply and remind ourselves about, maybe you're here today and life is falling apart. Maybe you're here today and you've just got problems. Life is just upside down. You've got worries, you've got fears, and it just doesn't seem to be going like you think it should be going. Well, you know, Israel had that problem as well. And in Isaiah chapter 40, isn't it amazing that was their issue when they were struggling? And of course, for them, it was in captivity that they'd been taken by the Babylon nation. But look at what God said to them. God said, "Why do you say, O Jacob, and complain, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint." It's a great application of creation, isn't it? Here God's reminding them in their dilemma and in their struggle. They just think God has forgotten them. He doesn't know what's going on in my world. And here he's saying, look at me, look around you. I can't give you the strength for what you're facing. I'm the all-powerful one. Don't look at your problems. Look at me, look at him. And Israel needed to hear that. And we need to hear that, don't we? We need to hear that God, that great God who created a perfect world, is involved in our lives. And he's so intimate and desires to be a part of that. But the other application I want to close with here as we just really wrap up the application here of Genesis 1 is really that the purpose of Genesis 1 is that God is establishing his rule and his presence. Okay? In other words, that's what Genesis 1 and 2 is pointing us to. That God is establishing his rule and his presence. Because when we saw that thing of God coming in his created world and the fact that he rested, that was actually used in that culture of the gods being present in the temple, and the pagan worshippers would worship their gods, and of course they would worship in the temple their gods. But you know what? God was the original idea of that, because when God rested and from his creation, the language suggests that it was God coming into his temple, as it were. What's his temple? Well, earth is his temple. And if you look at passages like Isaiah 66 and Psalm 132 that clearly talk about God's temple being the earth. The earth is his temple. So in a sense, God is, in that sense of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, 1 to 4, is coming into his temple, as it were. He's establishing his presence. And here, in a sense, of that Garden of Eden, which, by the way, the tabernacle, the dimensions of the tabernacle are a replica of that Garden of Eden, which, of course, that we know the tabernacle was all about the presence of God, God establishing his presence. So here in the beginning of Genesis 1, we see God, in that sense, creating the heavens and the earth as a good place for his people to experience his presence. And that's the big idea of Genesis 1 and 2. It's not all about the scientific facts and not about all the other questions that we'd have, but it's simply that he created the heavens and the earth as a good place for his people to experience his presence. That's what's going on in Genesis 1 and 2. And that's the storyline of the Bible, folks. And, well, we'll get to it, the mess and how that presence was lost and how God has re-established in his presence and, of course, ultimately in Jesus. But if you go on to Revelation 21, when all this is closing down and we see about God in his... there's no need for a temple. Isn't that what it says when John has that vision of heaven? Because we have the unfiltered presence of God with his people. As John looked forward to that day as eternity was beginning. But right back here, he's establishing his presence. And folks, Psalm 16:11 says, "You have made known to me the path of life. You fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand." Folks, we were made for the presence of God. That's what we are made for. And if you're here today and this is all new to you and you're not too sure what all this Christian thing and creation thing is, let me tell you, there is no satisfaction outside of the presence of God. There isn't. That's the longing we all have. And until we come to that place, that's where we are satisfied. And we can be looking in all sorts of other places, but there's no satisfaction in that. It's his presence, ultimately. I knew I'd have to come up with my cat story this week. And some of you know about my cat. In fact, some of you knew stuff about it before I even knew it this week. And when our cat couldn't have her kittens and had to have a section. And last Saturday when I was here and Loretta was spinning over to Ashbourne with our youngest daughter, Rachel, and the vet was waiting there to do the surgery. And and of course, had the section and there's two kittens in there and took the kittens out. And of course, the kittens were in another box because Loretta had to bring them back. And of course, Maya, the mother, was in her cage. And of course, they gave her a box to carry the little kittens. So they were sort of separate from each other for those that hour or so when Loretta and Rachel was coming from Ashbourne back home. But it was interesting because I got home before them next Saturday, last Saturday morning. And of course, I was looking forward. I knew they were coming home with the kittens at the back. And of course, I opened up the car. And of course, Rachel comes up holding up the two little kittens and size them, tiny little things. And he brought them upstairs. Of course, he brought Maya in the cage. But I tell you what stunned me. It was amazing because here then well, Loretta did, because the ladies, let's face it, they handle the kittens a lot more gentler than us men, don't they? Picked up the two little kittens and just, in that sense, introducing them to the mother. And the kittens in that sense now were in the presence of the mother. And of course, she licked them and smelt them. And of course, the bond then with the kittens, as you naturally would see in the presence of the mother, this is where they belong. This is what they were made for. And it's just been fascinating all week to look in there and look in the cage and see that when she comes out in the middle of the night to get a break from them, she gets away from them for a bit and they get all anxious, don't they? Because they were made for her presence, weren't they? That's where they're satisfied. That's where they're filled. That's what they're made for. And folks, that's what we're made for, the presence of God. In a sense, that's why he created us, for that longing, that intimate relationship, to experience his presence in a wonderful way. And he has done everything to do that. And it's only in that we find our rest and our satisfaction in him. And of course, we realize, first, that's acknowledging the God of creation. And of course, for those of us that know him, well, we continue we know we're in his presence. And in that sense, because of Jesus, God lives in us. He's with us, he's in us. Incredible. He's made his home with us. And that's ultimate satisfaction. Focus on that, follow that. That's the way of life. That's the way to experience life. And maybe for someone today who maybe hasn't made that step, he has done everything. He's come down ultimately in the presence of Jesus. You know, Jesus is the tabernacle ultimately. He dwelt among us. That means he tabernacled among us. And of course, he died on a cross and he lost the presence of God. He lost that intimacy with God. He was cut off from that when he was on the cross because he was paying the price for your sin and my sin that cut us off from God's presence. So we that could be eternally connected to him. The good news of the gospel is Jesus has done that. He has come down, God has come down and done what we couldn't do for ourselves to connect us with him. Ultimate presence, folks. That's Jesus. Look to him, turn to him, and call on him. That's ultimate life. That's life completely. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you indeed for this account that we've looked at today, and we praise you, Lord, in your grace and mercy. You recorded this for us so that we would know, we would be in no doubt as to who created the world that we're in. And why you created it, to establish your presence. And Lord, thank you that that's the idea that the people of Israel needed to grasp and know, and that's what we need to know today. And help us to remember that. Whatever we're battling or struggling with today, we realize that they're the issues, that's the answer to our issues. And maybe just remember that and worship you, Lord, and worship you today. And Lord, help us to do that, just to acknowledge that and realize how incredible you are and how blessed we are. So Lord, do that work in us today. May we be in wonder and worship at who you are and what you've done. And we give you thanks in Jesus' name. Amen, amen. No, if we have a closing song, have we? Or you have you?